welcome to the F1 Strategy Report for Formula Legend. On this week's edition, the Monaco Grand Prix, Daniel Ricciardo's robbed of victory around the streets of Monte Carlo. And why can't any team win a race properly? That's all to come in this edition of the Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato, and joining me this week on the program, he's a man I've known well for many years. He's from Box of Neutrals, which you may well have heard. His name's Rob James. How are you?
Hello, Michael. I actually know who you were supposed to have on this week, and I'm flattered to be in the same company as Person X.
Yeah, you were literally second on the list, which is pretty good company to be in, I think.
Yeah.
That man will be coming on a later program, we hope.
So. I get endorsements on LinkedIn for... He's very well at riding the coattails of people better than him. And just happy to sit in second.
Yeah, that's fine. It's a perfectly reasonable place to be.
Actually, one of my racing mottos, because I do some club kart racing, I hate being on pole position. Well, I have to be on pole in the first place. But if I were on pole, I would hate it because I don't like being hunted. I prefer the chase, to be honest.
It's just because there's no pressure, though.
Yeah.
But saying prefer the chase sounds very exciting. It sounds very cavalier. I like it.
Yeah, maybe or NASCAR.
maybe we can change that to the motto of the show to that. I don't know how that would go down with marketing, but we'll give it a go anyway. I'm glad as well, because so far, all of my guests on this program, we've only had one kind of dull race, as opposed to last year. I didn't have to host last year, so that was fine. But this year, all the races have been really good. Yeah. And also, perhaps surprisingly for Monaco, also really good.
It was. I mean, it Monaco is hardly the fastest Grand Prix in the world. I mean, if you're a massive fan of Grand Prix in Monza and Spa, you'd be sorely disappointed at the spectacle over in Monaco. But that said, the scale of the track, because it's so narrow. I mean, when I watch Formula One on television, I'm rarely astounded at the speed of the cars. There's only a handful of times where I really am. And watching qualifying on the Saturday, there were moments where I just went, whoa, geez, that's... That's quick. I mean, that final sector where Dan Ricciardo set the lap of the gods, as I'm calling it, even I had to go, oh, jeez, my heart skipped a little bit watching that because that looked mighty quick through there. So, yeah, what an amazing race to be reviewing this week.
Yeah, exactly. And it was. It's sort of watching a really good lap around Monaco is almost like controlled out of control at the same time because you have to be so close to that limit that people talk about in Formula One racing being on the limit. And, yeah, I think Daniel Ricciardo pole is a perfectly acceptable place to start for a race review. That pole position, fantastic. And the fact that Mercedes couldn't touch it. Nico Rosberg had to admit, I mean, Nico Rosberg's very good at admitting that he's not quickest on a day, he's not quickest, and he had to admit that. No credit to Lewis Hamilton saying, well, I should have got pole, because they just couldn't touch it. Even the Mercedes cars couldn't touch it.
Yeah, all weekend you had that sense for it when Dan wheeled out in Thursday practice the upgraded Renault/Tag Heuer motor aboard the Red Bull racing machine. Of course, we know the credentials of its chassis as well. So it was really, every Grand Prix, you tend to get a vibe of whose Grand Prix this will be aligned to. Sometimes it's a bit of a, you know, it could be three people, but it was the one weekend where you go, barring any sort of mishap from external sources, this one would be Ricciardo's to win for sure.
I thought it was interesting that in qualifying, Hamilton said, you know, I hope there's rain. It's the only way I'm going to win this race. Kind of worked out perfectly for him in some respects, because when we woke up on Sunday, it was wet. It was real wet. And rain sort of into the start of the race a little bit, dried up. And then subsequently, there wasn't really rain until the last couple of laps. But that didn't make any difference anyway, in any case. But the rain, in some respects, when it should have made it harder for Ricciardo, the safety car start, the first ever safety car start, incidentally, in Monte Carlo ever.
Really?
Good,
okay. Yeah.
I mean, I can't remember one. And no. Other people have safely reported so. So I'll just say that that's the case as well. Did help him off the line. But it did open up. Because, I mean, realistically, at Monaco, there's only one chance to make any difference. And it's around the pit stops.
Yeah.
But it created more of them, essentially. And it created more chance for there to be diversity. And so Red Bull Racing should have, at that point, had a decisive strategy. But it seemed like they just didn't, despite having such a comfortable lead.
Yeah, but to be honest, that first portion of the race where it was wet, then it started to dry out, and then you're wondering, oh, everyone's who's going to go on inters? And then we saw, I think it was Ericsson in the Sauber, was the first one to pit. And then eventually everyone sort of copycatted that move. apart from Lewis Hamilton, he was just like, well, I'm still setting fastest laps in the wet. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was remarkable. We had, what, five tyres going through this race in total. You saw the wet, you saw the inters, you saw the soft, ultra soft and super soft. I mean, in terms of, it was almost like an accidental tyre war that we saw.
Well, I think around lap 30, when there were a whole bunch of pit stops, there was the final pit stop window, literally every tyre was on a car somewhere, all five of them, which is ludicrous to consider, really. But it does go to show, and what I think has not been talked about enough, is that last year, and in years past indeed, the wet tyre has been a pretty average tyre, it's got to be said. None of the drivers like it, partly because races that are wet enough for the wet tyre normally have a safety car involvement, so there's very little racing on the wet tyre. But generally, it was not a tyre anyone wanted to be on. But not only was it a very effective tyre around Monaco, yes, there's not a lot of degradation around Monaco, but nonetheless, it worked for Hamilton for 31 laps, and last, let's say, 10 of those laps, the track was very dry.
Yeah. I mean, it shouldn't happen. I mean, you see it in other races gone by. They last barely a handful of laps. I mean, it's the reason why they often use wet tyres as demonstration tyres to do burnouts at exhibitions. I mean, I was absolutely staggered at how dry it was. Yeah, there were a couple of wet patches, but surely that would have been better suited to the intermediate tyre. And even the intermediate was a bit weird. I mean, we saw Max Verstappen aboard the Red Bull car sort of very, very taily and gaining a lot of wheel spin, whereas Hamilton managed to save his wet tyres. I mean, it was mighty impressive how durable they were and how he made them last for as long as they did. And I mean, it was just remarkable that even after Ricciardo's botched pit stop, which I'm sure we'll debrief on later,
I reckon we might touch on it.
that Hamilton, you know, could eventually come out just in front of Ricciardo, because you would think that if, much like Nico Rosberg, who was unusually slow for much of the race, he would have thought, oh, surely he's just, you know, just driving to the conditions of the tyre and just holding up Ricciardo. But no, that was genuinely good pace, and obviously the various fastest lap times on a wet tyre on a dry track is unless we get another similar Monaco Grand Prix in the future year, I don't think that's something we're going to ever see in Formula 1 again.
I think actually, I mean, we're saying similar Monaco Grand Prix. Hamilton's only other victory, before we pull out a couple more points, to go back to 2008. That was also a wet start. And I'm pretty sure, because what he took the lead, when did he take the lead for the first time? Like lap, what is it, 20-something? Or in the 30s the second time. I actually have a feeling that's exactly when he took the lead in 2008 as well. In fact, I think I've seen someone ride as much. This was almost exactly the same race. It takes the exact same conditions for Hamilton to win the Monaco Grand Prix. But we sort of said there were three things that put Hamilton into the frame for the win for this. It was the fact that Pirelli's got this new wet tyre, which they were testing at January, people might remember, with, I think it was a Ferrari, a Mercedes and a Red Bull racing car in any case.
Convenient.
Yes. Oh, it works out, doesn't it? At the same site where the old testing controversy for Pirelli its head a couple of years ago.
It would have been no good if it was a Sauber testing the tyres, because it would have just crashed into each other.
Ericsson in third. What's this about? It would be very strange. There was that. There was the fact that Rosberg, who qualified second, it must be said. In fact, you'll see Rosberg mentioned almost no race reports because he finished seventh in the end. But
he deserve to get a mention.
No, he frankly, he does not. He did have brake temperature issues, to his credit. Yeah. Although so did Hamilton to some degree. It just seemed maybe Hamilton worked around them better. But Rosberg was nowhere in this race. So him being moved aside, which I thought was interesting for Mercedes to actively say, hey, Nico, get out of the way, you're too slow, on very early on in the race.
The winner of the last three Monaco Grand Prix.
Yeah, exactly. And it entitled Hamilton to eventually take his first win since October, which is a very long time ago. Yeah. And then, of course, the pit stops all aligned to give Hamilton this position to take the win. Of course, there was more to it than just that. And then we did get to, and it plays into the fact that the tyres are a little bit different. We used to see this cutoff, and Jenson Button sort of nailed the cutoff in Monaco again, but he said after the race it was a shame that everyone else did it as well, so there was no advantage to it. But the fact that there's not enough difference between the wet and the intermediate anymore means there's not as much of a reward to feel that gap. And so the result was a whole bunch of people switched to the intermediates, as you said, and fastest times were still being traded between Hamilton on the wets, Ricciardo on the wets, and everyone else on the inters. So there actually wasn't the strategy we were expecting in that opening part of the race.
I think it was a bit of a panic, because I seem to recall when the early guys, like when you saw Jenson Button pop up on the timing screens with fastest lap, McLaren, Honda, this tyre's got to work, surely we can be quicker than that. So I think it was maybe a case of people reacting to the unusual lap times being set by some cars you normally wouldn't expect to be setting fastest lap times, even at that early stage of the Grand Prix.
Yeah, and so we got to this point where there are only two people on the entire track that sort of sensed that maybe the wets are better than we were used to, and they were Lewis Hamilton, conveniently enough, and also Pascal Wehrlein, who didn't really play a part in this race at all. So we'll move past him. But it's interesting to consider that the window to change to the slicks, and everyone agreed on this window because everyone changed within about three laps of each other. It was around about lap 30, was only seven laps later than Ricciardo switched to the intermediates. And yes, the intermediates were the tyre to be on at the time by the end of that stint. But it's interesting that for the second race in a row, Red Bull, on a circuit where everyone knows you can't overtake, it's not a surprise to anyone, have gambled track position on an extra stop for some reason.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, we all thought it was maybe a bit unusual to go on the inters that late, but we thought, no, this will be all right. And had, even with that pit strategy, had they not absolutely made a mess of that pit stop, we saw Ricciardo just come out just behind Lewis Hamilton. If they even if they fumbled the wheels as well, let alone not have them ready at all, even if they put them on, even if they had them ready when Ricciardo came into the box, still had a fumble, Ricciardo would have just been in front. It would have been a bit touch and go, and whether, you know, the other consequences of that, whether Hamilton and Ricciardo would have had another dive at another corner, who knows, they may have collided into each other. We don't know those what-if scenarios, but this was just a plain old, just a colossal stuff-up, and Daniel Ricciardo has every right to be upset. I mean, I remarked, and I got scolded on social media for this. I don't know how to react when people say you're an idiot for this, that, and the other. I put out the very controversial thought, and I know that Ricciardo is a somewhat protected species all around the world, not just Australia.
He's just so smiley.
That despite the Red Bull stuff-up in the pits, the two lockups that Ricciardo incurred, through Raskas. I can't remember the points in time, but he had some fairly sizable lockups when he was very close to Hamilton, within sort of, in that DRS range. And I know it's Monaco, and I know that you could easily catch up to cars later on, but having a lockup at Monaco just amplifies it even more. I mean, if Ricciardo didn't have the lockup, he would have been close. Probably would have had another couple of attempts to make a pass on Hamilton. And you know, to be honest, I'm gonna put it 99.98% of the blame on the mechanics at a very, very, very small portion. And I know the circumstances, because Ricciardo, he wouldn't have had to push if he wasn't fighting for position. But nonetheless, he could have had a couple of opportunities to pass him on his own, have his own street fight with Hamilton, and pass him genuinely for the lead. I mean, if that had happened, geez, that would the whole Red Bull pit stop thing would not be an issue. We wouldn't be talking about this.
Mm-hmm. I think there are two points to consider that. On the pit stop, first of all, he was in a position to possibly come out ahead of Hamilton, because if you compare the in and out laps of those two drivers, Ricciardo's were, again, mind-boggling, considering where he was in the race. Yes, he had fresher tyres at that point. They were new inters compared to Hamilton's old wets. But he did such fantastic in-laps that he was in a position whereby, they could have fumbled the tyres and still emerged in the lead. The fumble was much too big, it turned out, and he didn't take the lead.
You can have one fumble, it's fumbles.
If they'd only forgotten one tyre, maybe they'd been okay. But all four is just too much to bear, guys. And then the lockups, but I think that really goes to show, it's something that Hamilton said, well, it was last year when he was in, I guess, a similar position, when he'd been pitted late for tyres for no reason and ended up behind Vettel and Rosberg, is that when you've got cars of very similar performance, especially around somewhere like Monaco, it's just too hard to follow. The aerodynamics of the cars means, and of course, what's the first part of aerodynamics that is disrupted on a car? It's the front wing and the front wheels. And
just ask Kimi Raikkonen that question.
Yeah, exactly. And then it all goes wrong from there. Whereas you see Verstappen early in the race, before he found the barrier, he was passing the very much slower cars compared to his Red Bull Racing car very easily, because the performance gap was so great, and also because he's Max Verstappen.
That's true. I was thinking about this today. I was reflecting with a friend about the race and just going, Max Verstappen, and I was remarking how it's a lot easier to peg down a very fast driver than to try to speed up a very slow driver.
Yeah.
I'm that case in point of being the slow driver. But he passed some cars that were very easy to pass, but Monaco's not exactly the easiest circuit to do
absolutely.
It, and especially in the conditions that they were in, where it was wet. You know, you go offline, you mount a wheel on the curb, you could just easily loop it. So Max was incredibly impressive, and I almost feared to think what might have been had he just kept on going the way he was going. Top five for sure, top three.
Would have been fascinating, wouldn't it? Yeah. Because, yeah, and it's often been said, you know, Max Verstappen, he's very young, but he's a bit rough, as Monaco has proved, I think. But he's the kind of driver whose attitude, perhaps because he's so young and has only had 3 years in a car ever in his life, is that he goes for something and then figures out the consequences later.
Yes.
And in most circuits, that's fine. You go on the grass a bit, you maybe lose 5 seconds and you get back on. Maybe there's asphalt, you lose no seconds. You pass a car, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Monaco, you can't do that. And I think that's something he'll learn over time. Even something as simple, I mean, consider the accident that broke his chassis in qualifying. Broke his chassis, that's huge. Was just him turning slightly too early out of the swimming pool section.
Yeah.
You know, any other circuit in the world, he'd probably have gained time from doing that.
Yeah.
But you just can't in Monaco, and that was always a risk for him here, I think.
Yeah, I think in Formula One and indeed in motor racing generally, I think the experienced racing drivers can build what I call up discrimination. So the more times that you do it, the more sort of different lessons that you learn. You kind of just... stop taking risks is not what I'm after in saying. It's just you sort of calculate it a bit more. And you try a different way. You might wait a couple of more laps. I mean, for example, you wouldn't have seen Jenson Button pulling a similar move because he would just know, yeah, I'm not going to whack the barrier. That's a dumb thing to do. Whereas Max would go, oh, yeah, well, that happened. Okay, I won't do that again, maybe.
Yeah, so it'd be unlikely you'd think to see Verstappen ever crash in those places again. Yeah. But oh, wait and see. Maybe we shouldn't say that so early.
Maybe it's like, oh, maybe if I try it in fifth. See how that goes.
Yeah. And meanwhile, so obviously that panned out in the favour of Hamilton, because after the switch to slick tyres, despite there being sort of a bit of a line ball call to move to the ultra soft tyres, it turned out they worked fine. There was a little grip on Monaco that they were probably brand new by the time they took them off the car. And indeed, the super soft performed well. Even the soft performed really well. There was such a little performance differentiation between any of them. And in fact, it was the soft that delivered Sergio Perez to his first Monaco podium, the first Mexican on a Monaco podium. He's still the only Force India to get a podium, but between him and Hülkenberg, it's shocking to think Hülkenberg doesn't have a podium at this point, but he's the man, despite what everyone says about Sergio Perez. He's the one who keeps delivering in this partnership.
Should he have been on a podium?
No, but
Fisichella.
Fisichella was. Yeah. It was who I was thinking of. I don't think Sutil ever was. Someone can check that for us, I'm sure, and write an angry letter to Strategies Report.
Sergio Perez, remarkable. I know in terms of that midfield battle, it's sort of very line and ball between Force India and Williams just had an atrocious weekend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just generally was embarrassing, but to be frank, they probably would have gone, right, let's just get through this, just forget about it.
Close your eyes.
Don't worry about it. Just finish and pack up. let's go to Montreal where we can hopefully rustle up a better result. The Force India tend to do quite well over in Monaco, and of course they have the upgraded car that came online in the previous round in Spain. Sergio Perez, of course, a master in Monaco before in GP2. But importantly, though, we had a conversation in the week about. So Vettel finished in P4 in the factory Ferrari, and I think we were talking about how, what happens at Ferrari when the Force India finishes higher on the podium, and we jokingly remark someone just gets sacked afterwards. Hasn't happened yet at the time of this recording.
That's still time.
If you look at Perez, he came in for the softs on lap 30 and Vettel on lap 31. So there wasn't much. It wasn't like Vettel came in, 10 laps later. It wasn't a complete stuff up in that regard. It was that they were very evenly matched in that regard. And again, Perez had a very shorter window on the inters. Maybe Vettel just chewed up his inters a lot more.
Yeah, well, I think it went to show that Ferrari seemed, I mean, A, they shouldn't have qualified so lowly. They were sort of a bit nowhere in qualifying. They've been a bit nowhere all year, almost, since Melbourne, since that time they led a race. They tried, I guess, what you could call the undercut, or more accurately in these conditions, they tried to be ambitious and went to the inter early. Not that early, though, mind you. Lap 13. Other cars had been on it far earlier. And that undid what could have been, around any other circuit, a strategy that put him onto the podium. But nonetheless, he could make no impression on the Force India car. The Force India car, which is, over the past couple of years, and at the hands of Sergio Perez as well, proved pretty handy. And you can't help but think what's going to happen for the rest of the year. Now they've got, as you said, that upgraded package. They've got the class-leading power unit. And in Hülkenberg and Perez, two really good drivers.
Yeah, and they got some of the go-fast factory bits for the Mercedes team. So they've essentially become a pseudo-satellite operation of Mercedes Grand Prix. But equally as well, Nico Hülkenberg had a steady result, passing, ironically, the factory Mercedes of Nico Rosberg, I think on the final corner of the final lap.
Absolutely, yeah. When it was starting to get, well, this is what Rosberg says, it was raining a little bit, and his tyres were old. Rosberg's tyres were a little bit older and harder.
Well, where is it with Jeremy? With Timo Glock in Brazil in 2008, they just can't handle last lap rain.
Just moderate rain. They can't. Well, it was much worse in Brazil anyway. But it was a terrible weekend for Ferrari in that respect. Fourth doesn't sound terrible, but I mean, when you consider Ferrari's been looking for a win since, what, 2001 in Monaco. Not that they were ever really in the frame for a win here. Raikkonen was the other man that compounded the weekend by just a really... just some really average behaviour, I would describe it, into the hairpin.
Raikkonen's an odd unit at the best of times on off the track, but on it, he's either on it or he's not. And neither he nor there about caring about how well he's going. He's sort of like, well, that's the result. We'll worry about the next round. Obviously, he goes out there, I'm sure, with the intention of winning every single race he enters. But there's sort of it's that fire that he's not as confused and upset as, say, Sebastian Vettel is as to the situation that he finds himself in, which I find Sebastian Vettel utterly infuriating at this point of time. But regardless of that, I was just watching some old Formula One races in the week, and you know, you watch Kimi Raikkonen 10 years ago, and you just go, geez, this guy was electric. I mean, I hasten to think in 10 years' time, we see a very tempered Max Verstappen, where he's sort of twiddling around sixth place and quite satisfied with
collecting
that.
A front wing in the tunnel and just trying for some reason to continue.
Yeah, just sort of, it was just very, very clumsy. But, you know, whether we see Raikkonen again in Formula One, I find it bizarre. He's still one of the most popular drivers.
I know, right?
He has this weird
nothing
following
him, but, you know,
for a whole bunch of, you know, nothing results.
Yeah, and it is a little bit sad in that context. I mean, he's a world champion, one of the most exciting drivers of past. Although all the rumours are, all the word is that he will be retained next year because Sebastian Vettel's not threatened by him.
He's only about four or five points behind Ricciardo in the championship standing. 61,
he's been very
66.
Consistent this year.
Yeah, so, I think he was as high as second or third.
He was second in the championship last week, I'm pretty sure, coming into Monaco.
Yeah.
Because the Mercedes cars retired, so Hamilton dropped down. But also just because he's always been there. He's always been roughly there, which has been, to his credit, very good.
Absolutely. To his credit, he's been the moniker of consistency this season. But consistency, just quite frankly, is not going to cut it at Ferrari. That said, he's the number two driver, let's be honest, in that team. But it's almost like the Rubens Barrichello effect of like, gee, he shouldn't be this high up in the championship. I think it was, what, 2003? Rubens was unusually high in the championship that year.
Just felt weird. Yeah. It's like temporarily when you're like, oh, Rubens might win the championship for Braun. You're like, no, that's not going to happen. I don't think so. Although I do love Rubens. And so it's interesting times for Ferrari. It's the story we've been following since the start of the year when they should have been threatening for wins and they just can't, like anyone else. In fact, I'm willing to say, of all the teams and drivers that have now been in contention for victory, and I'm including Max Verstappen's win, not Max Verstappen himself, obviously, because that was an accident on Red Bull's part. No team other than Mercedes has been able to actually execute a full weekend competently. Mercedes is the only ones, and I think Monaco is a great example where they were in the position to capitalize on other teams getting it wrong.
Yep.
But from Ferrari in Australia to Red Bull in Barcelona and Monaco, no teams actually... teams have been in position to threaten and just gone, I don't know, and thrown all their cards up in the air and just hope for the best.
The only wobble we saw from Mercedes were the two blokes behind the wheel in Spain. And even then, the team handled it really well.
And then they just opened the opportunity for Red Bull and Ferrari to both get their strategies wrong. And then all of a sudden, oh, what? Oh, Max Verstappen's won. It was exactly like 2010 Abu Dhabi, the championship finale. No one thought Sebastian Vettel was going to win the championship. Yeah. And then Mark Webber, Fernando Alonso, they just forget what they're doing and fight each other. And then all of a sudden, this kid's won the championship.
It is amazing how long have we been Formula One in?
Oh, it's just ages.
Formula One teams still find new lessons after every weekend. We're going, oh, gee, we shouldn't do that again. We've been doing this for 60-odd years.
Yeah.
Surely we've learned all the lessons in the book, but I'm just staggered. Every single race, you learn something new every single time. And I think that's, to be honest, it's quite endearing.
Well, that's a good, it's true. I mean, it just shows that Formula One, it can't get arrogant. Can't get too arrogant.
No.
It can be arrogant. It is arrogant a little bit. It would be remiss of us not to touch on Williams, because they're the fading story of the current generation I think it's fair to say. Yeah. Although, to be fair, no one ever expected them to do well at Monaco because they haven't in this era because their car's just not designed for it. Subtle improvements. They got a point, I think I'm right in saying, or possibly two, which is an improvement on last year and the year before where they were just nowhere. But I think it still goes to show they just don't have the resources to correct these problems. And we see the likes of Ferrari and Red Bull over the last couple of years finding what's wrong with them and fixing it to the point now where they're both pretty rounded, well-rounded packages. Williams, not so.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it's an indictment on whether there's a ceiling to being a customer team. I mean, let's face it, Williams, very much a customer of Mercedes. Even if they got a lot more sort of resources from the factory squad, once they sort of, you know, start outperforming the factory team, you would expect less and less support to be given. You know, instead of, oh, yeah, we'll give you this part in 10 minutes, we'll be like, oh, can we give it to you tomorrow kind of thing. It's just, I failed to see how Williams need to make a massive step or do another fundamental change. I mean, we saw them have an evolution when they reunited with Renault in 2012 and Pastor Maldonado somehow waltzed his way into a bizarre victory that year in 2012 in Spain to just an utterly mediocre season soon after that. The V6 era was a bit of renewal for Williams, and it was much refreshing and welcoming to see because it was looking quite dire for the squad. You only have to look at Sauber of how desperate you can get in Formula One when the chips are really, really down. Anyway, it's good to see that Williams is in, you know, some sort of good health as a business, but right now it's sort of, they sort of had a bit of a rise and it sort of peaked without actually peaking the way a lot of people would have expected. I mean, we saw sometimes it's, you know, Italian or Belgian Grand Prix where you go, surely you got to win this Grand Prix because you got the slipperiest car and the fastest car in a straight line, even quicker than the Mercs. And they failed to capitalize on those opportunities. So whether, and you know, come those times again, I failed to see them doing it again. So unless they go for another fundamental change, you know, whether it's dare they go with a Honda customer route. Not even Honda customer, whether they have a, you know, they split the factory operation at Honda between McLaren and Williams. Because, you know, to be honest, yes, I know it's very much at the sort of helm of McLaren as to what Honda do with that engine. But, you know, if you were Honda, you would want to have as many sort of pseudo factory teams having some good bits to really develop that engine.
And it must be painful to see on a weekend where a Mercedes customer team in Force India can get a podium that Williams can't. I know consistently, like over the course of a season, Williams car tends to get better results, but then we are also seeing the grid shrink up. Maybe Williams won't beat Force India this year. We don't know now that Force India is stretching the legs of this B-spec car. And I mean, that we should also say credit to Force India in that respect. That's not to say that Williams is desperately underperforming, but when Force India is run by a guy who has an arrest warrant for him and won't leave the UK. Like, you've got to think, come on, like, there's got to be something here.
Exactly. Well, it was good for Sergio to thank his boss, who's very much a wanted man.
Apparently the money keeps coming in, so what can you do?
But you tend to find this in motor racing where you develop a car, you keep developing it, and you sort of just get, oh my God, we're still finishing in the same position. But it's because you're finding everybody else up the front and below you is still developing at the same level as you. Unless you take another two or three or four levels ahead of your nearest rival and then some, or much like next year, we see a sort of a fundamental change in the regulations where you can sort of take a loophole and suddenly go from not being an absolute basket case of an Earth Dreams Honda Formula One car to being the world champion Braun team the very next season. You've got to capitalize on those moments where we go, you know, forget about it. This generation of car, we've hit the sort of peak of its lifespan. We've got to worry about the whole new car. And, you know, you have to wonder which of those teams are sort of going, okay, let's forget about 2016. Let's just sort of, you know, at least poodle around and get points for Constructors' Championship. Let's aim big picture for 2017 beyond.
And that decision's going to start being made now. But that was the Monaco Grand Prix. Unusually, perhaps, exciting Monaco Grand Prix.
Yeah. I mean, for we saw some very fast manoeuvres in Barcelona at the previous round. I mean, I was absolutely gobsmacked by Dan Ricciardo's pass at Sebastian Vettel in turn
pass,
one.
If you will.
Yeah, his ping pong maneuver at turn one, over 300 kilometres on the brakes.
Some fast ping pong.
But Monaco was absolutely brilliant, but it was brilliant for being one of the most clumsiest displays of Formula One I've ever seen, but I loved every second of it. It's amazing. Monaco in the wet is the least flattering. If you showed someone who'd never seen a Formula One race and you showed them the Monaco Grand Prix, you just go, what is this?
Why are they so close to the walls?
It's like watching supermarket trolleys just sort of being pushed in the wind. They just sort of look so cumbersome. They're not. They sound like they're idling. They're in first and second gear. They're crashing into hairpins. Oh. But it was. I had a smile on my face every single lap, even when Ricciardo was absolutely robbed of victory by Joe Mechanics.
Robbed. And once again, we've seen, and we can't thank Pirelli enough on this program for delivering tyres that are really working for racing. But that's been the strategy report for the Monaco Grand Prix. Rob James, where can people find you?
They can find me in my car, normally.
Yep. But it's not, yellow.
At Rob James RJ on Twitter, or they can also hear myself and Peter McGinley and Michael something, Laminara.
He's my least favourite one.
That's Box of Neutrals. Every Friday. It's sort of your end of week, light-hearted view of Formula One.
Yeah, by the time the race has been forgotten, we'll remind you of it. Still topical, I promise. Rob James, thank you so much for joining me.
No worries, Mike.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of The Strategy Report. You can find The Strategy Report on Facebook, search F1 Strategy Report, or follow at Strategy Report on Twitter. If you want to read more about the strategy of the Monaco Grand Prix, you can go to f1strategyreport.com and follow the links to Jack Leslie's write-up of all the action from Monte Carlo. My name's Michael Laminato. You can find me at Michael Laminato on Twitter. And be sure to join me in 2 weeks' time when we look back on the Canadian Grand Prix.